Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us for our Best of Memorial Day edition. Reach back to September for a couple of guests that I think are perfect, and they cover our Navy Marine Corps history from World War II, the Korean War, through the early parts of the Cold War. Please enjoy our guests, Eddie LeBaron and Lanier Phillips, and we hope to see you next week. Hope you had a great weekend and have a great Navy Day. Our first guest, Eddie LeBaron, just as a quick background for you young pups that may not have read your books. Though known many times as a four-time Pro Bowler, quarterback for the Washington Redskins in the 1950s, and Tom Landry's first quarterback in Dallas, also Don Meredith's mentor. He was also, more importantly, in many respects, a Marine Corps lieutenant in the Korean conflict, where he was decorated with the Purple Heart and awarded the Bronze Star. Mr. LeBaron, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
And thank you very much for coming on this afternoon, especially when we got football season going along. But this is a great opportunity, I think, for a lot of our listeners, as we were talking before the show, that a lot of people will read about World War II or they'll read about the Korean War, and they don't get a chance to talk to the people who were there. They don't get to see them in 3D. And when a lot of people know of Eddie LeBaron, unless they pull the string a little bit, they know about the football player, but what they don't know about the young man who at 21 who was leading Marines in combat in Korea. If you could please, just how did you find yourself getting commissioned in the Marine Corps, and how did you find your way to Korea?
Well, I was in the Marine Reserve. I joined it when I was in college, when I was 18, I think, and I was back at the College All-Star game. We played the Eagles that year and won. And as the Korean War broke out, and they called up the reserve, and so I went in and I had an opportunity to become an officer and go to Quantico, the basic school. And so I did, and I was in the midst of basic school, and our group, which we still meet every 5 years, that was in the basic school. Most of us went to Korea right after that because they were running short of platoon leaders over there. So that's kind of how I got over there.
Eagle One?
Well, if you were in the Marines, as you said, when you were in college in the reserves, can you describe kind of the impact of the Marine Corps on your life after that period, other than the Korean War, obviously?
You know, I've talked about this before as far as the Marines and thought a lot about it, but I think it's a great experience. Sometimes it's not a great experience to get shot at and hit, but it's you learn a discipline. You learn that you have to make good decisions or the costs are very high. So it's and you have to work hard to I was probably in better condition over there than anywhere I've ever been, but it was a great experience, and I think the quality of time you spend with your people is very important, and I really enjoyed my time in the Marine Corps. I thought it was a great and wonderful experience, and I'm glad I went through it all.
You know, it's interesting. I think in the military is one of the few places where you can be 21, 22, 23 and be considered an old man. I guess, when you're leading people that are 18, 19, and 20, you are kind of the old and experienced man. But I think in many respects that's true in football as well at the college level. But when you get into professional sports, of course, you have some of the your leaders really stay on and on and on in some of the professional teams. And back when you started playing with professional sports, there were quite a few professional athletes who had experience in combat, both in World War II and in Korea. I think nowadays, unfortunately, I think you really don't see that, but things have changed so much in sports. How many other people did you run into when you're playing professional ball that were combat veterans, and did you notice how they helped establish a leadership position on their team different than perhaps those that did not?
Well, they're more disciplined, I think, but the number was quite a few because basically everyone that of that age that went into the service in World War II, and when I started in the NFL, I was 20 and I had just gotten out of school. I'd started college when I was 16, and but I hadn't been in the service yet. But most of the other guys who came up had been in the service, and it was an interesting thing. I think what you learn, you get a maturity that you probably otherwise might not have. You when they were going to school, they had a bigger desire and to get an education, and I think the same is true in the NFL. They were a bunch of people who had been through tough times, and they knew what it was, and so they didn't mind working hard and doing all the things necessary to become a good football player.
When you were playing pro ball back in the early in the 50s, the salaries were nowhere comparable to what they are today, and many people had, I guess, other jobs. How did that work out for during the off season or during the season?
Well, most everyone else had jobs. When I joined the Redskins, my first contract was 1950. Then I went in the service, but I didn't play that year. Came back in 52. But Mr. Marshall, the owner of the Redskins at the time, said, he said, players are greedy these days. It's no fun being an owner anymore. They want so much money. He said, do you realize this year my payroll will exceed, for 33 players, $175,000? And that's well under the minimum salary now in the NFL. But so 33 guys split up $175,000. So basically, everyone had some kind of work, and they were preparing for later on. I went to law school, and so my last year with the Redskins in 1959, I had already passed the California bar and graduated from George Washington Law School, and my two halfbacks both were going to med school, and they became doctors. So it was a time when football was a lot of fun to play, and you enjoyed it, but you knew you had to do something else to get by, because it wasn't a long-lived thing, and you didn't make enough money to save a lot.
It's funny, your two halfbacks going to medical school. I think playing professional ball back when you did, but you didn't quite have the protection that you had. They got a good on the job training, so to speak, for medical care on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's right.
With your legal background and what that comes into it, I think you saw an interesting transition for professional ball from Washington to when you moved out in Dallas. At least for somebody of my generation, when you think of a football empire, it was the Dallas Cowboys. They just dominated things when I was growing up. And you were there as it started and just expanded. When did you really see the shift from professional ball as it was played when you were in with the Redskins to as the Dallas program started to grow along with the NFL?
Well, the Dallas program was started out where we weren't even the top team in Dallas. The American Football League had started, and Lamar Hunt had the team that is now Kansas City there, and the Texans, and they were the favored team at that time. And we came in later. The NFL gave Dallas a franchise because they wanted to preserve that area for the NFL. So we got in, but we didn't even have a draft. They traded for me, and they got Meredith on some kind of trade, and so it was interesting times. But we weren't America's team then. We weren't even Dallas's team.
when you look at coming back into the NFL after having served in the Marine Corps. And there don't seem to be as many players doing that these days. I can think of maybe Roger Staubach and maybe Napoleon McCollum and a couple of others. But is there room for a player to fulfill some active duty obligation and then come in the service, or is he just going to be too old by the time he completes 4 or 5 years of active duty?
Well, I don't think he'll be too old. I mean, Roger. Was because he went to Annapolis. I think he had a 4-year contract to serve, and he was over in Vietnam. But I don't think so. The problem is you're not practicing and you're not playing. You're doing military things, and you might not have your techniques and your skills develop to the point where you need them when you come into the NFL. And I don't know. I don't see it as an impossible thing, but it's difficult.
When I walk through D.C., I'm kind of a history geek in some respects, and I'm a museum guy, but I really like memorials too. And this isn't really editorial here. This is just my personal taste. But when I walk through D.C., I'm not a big fan of the Vietnam War Memorial from a thematic point of view. And though it's a grand memorial, the World War II Memorial, I think, is a little bit too grand, especially compared to the World War I Memorial that almost looks like a fountain. But when you walk through the Korean War Memorial, I think the artist who built that and the designers that did that, I think did a very impressive job. If anybody finds themselves in Washington, D.C., and it's a snowstorm, I always say go out at night and we'll go over to the Korean War Memorial. As a Korean War veteran, how do you look at that memorial, and how do other Korean War veterans look at that memorial? Does it catch what you think is right from a mood point of view? How do you feel about the memorial?
Well, I think it's a wonderful memorial, and I think it does catch the mood of the times. And together with the new history memorial they built in Quantico, which is really something. They have rooms where they show Korean scenes, and it's kept at about 40 degrees, and so it's really interesting. And but no, they. I used to take people, and when I was doing some work up here, around and show them the memorials, and they were very impressed with them.
You go on.
When you came back to the NFL after having been in Korea and in combat, let's see if I can phrase this question the right way. Everybody talks about the speed of the game, that there's a different speed between the college game and the professional game. Did you find that the speed of the game was that much different than combat, or is it slower than combat, or is it different than combat? How did you do that, if you can make a distinction like that?
Well, it's different. I mean, you the plays are done in 60 minutes of play time, a couple hours or so. The the game's over. In combat, you're going 24 hours a day, and we were in Korea. My people were in fantastic shape because we were walking up and down hills all day, and so it was. You had to be in shape, but a different kind of shape than you take to play in the NFL. But I think when you're young, you can do a lot of things, and you can come back quickly. And I think the experience of making quick decisions and having to be right on your decisions that you get in combat is very important for playing for a quarterback.
Have you had a chance in the last couple of decades, but really, I guess, 10 years would be the most dramatic, to return back to Korea and see the sacrifice that you and those others that served in Korea made to give the Korean people a chance to see what South Korea has created compared to where it used to be?
No, I haven't been back, and I've had offers to go back, and I gave it some thought, but Korea is a completely different place, South Korea at least, and
sure.
I don't think North is a whole lot different than that. But we were spent some time in the North at the end of my time over there. But everything was torn up, and so now it's a great country as far as the economy goes, the work ethic and all that. So, yeah, it's completely different. But I thought the people were very nice. Now, but one thing that kept me from going back, I planted a lot of mines and places over there, and I didn't want to go back where I did that.
A good reason to me, but I had a Korean War vet who once told me that when people will ask him, was the effort worth it, he would just say, just go look at pictures of Korea and see the Korean-owned automobile manufacturers that are here in the U.S. employing a few thousand people. He said, if that doesn't answer your question, then nothing that I say will. Eagle One.
Yeah, no, that's right. They've done a tremendous job of coming back. But I have a lot of people who were in basic school with me who have been back, and they say it's completely different.
When you went on to Atlanta to become the manager, I guess, of the Falcons,
right? General manager and part
general
of
manager. Yeah. Well, did you get any? I'm going to ask. Did you learn any Marine Corps? Did you bring any Marine Corps leadership lessons to that position?
What you learn in the Marine Corps confess goes through the football and also the management part of it. You're in the midst of making decisions, and I'd been in law firms in the meantime, and so I was used to doing some of that, but you learn from the experience that you win some battles and lose some battles, and you have to be ready for the next one.
Also, different personalities always require different methods. And when you did some broadcasting, and I thought one of the great scenes from what I consider a great sports movie with the Durham Bulls. And all that good stuff was the advice he gave about whenever you're interviewed, just to speak a bunch of meaningless platitudes back to whoever's interviewing you, and it sounds good, and you don't give away anything. But as an announcer and having to deal with players from that perspective, but also being in management, have we advanced to the point that it's really difficult to have a real candid conversation with the players? Are they too well coached? How do you see that relationship that has changed through the years between the players and the media, and how management tries to control that message?
Well, when I broadcast, I broadcast with Jack Buck, Joe's father, for a few years, and I hadn't been out of football that long, so I knew all the people, and I could talk to them, and I knew the questions they didn't want to talk about, but I was able to get, you know, do fairly well in getting answers out of them because they had trust. But I think it's management has some problems, it's always difficult because you're head to head on some things, and especially when times like this, when the labor deals are up. I was kind of got involved in running the strike games back in 80, whenever the strike went, and I was
right.
In New York, and so you lose your ability to be close to the players. But it's I think as long as everyone is for the league doing well, you can work most things out.
Eagle One?
When you look back on, I mean, you were 5'7" or 5'9" playing football, and
5'7".
Okay. You have a good publicist somewhere who claims you were much taller at 5'9". We don't see people that size in professional football much anymore. I think maybe the last quarterback even close to that was Doug Flutie. But part of your success, I think, was you had a very quick release, a high and quick release on the ball. Is there a place for the small man in football these days?
Well, everyone's bigger now. And I, even though I was small, I used to, when I played in a few Pro Bowl games, I'd get together with the quarterback and we'd see where we release it. And I usually release it higher than a 6 foot guy. But it's getting rid of the ball to the right spot in time. And, you've got to, your technique has got to be good, and your quickness and ability to run and all those other things. And I think good athletes can still play even though they're smaller. But I think we had Big Daddy Lipscomb, who was 6'7", and people like that. But nowadays everyone's 6'5", or 6'7". I don't think a smaller guy has a terrible problem if he has the right technique and is a good athlete.
One of the commenters in our chat room came up with an interesting question, kind of going back to the Marine Corps side of your personality. Obviously, the Marine Corps has never changed their uniform and their look, and they're as tribalistic as they've ever been, at least from the outside. Because I'm a Navy guy, but you've been around Marines for well over half a century. Do you see any difference from the Marines that you served with back in the 50s to the Marines that you meet now, or is that continuity and that brotherhood such that you can almost replace one personality for another from generation to generation?
I work with the recruiting people in the Sacramento area, and our little group of Marine types in Sacramento put on the Marine Corps birthday every year out there, and so I don't see any difference. I see well trained people in the uniforms. I think if it's not broke, don't replace it with. There's tradition, and I think that's terribly important. And I think the uniforms don't change, the work ethic of the people don't change, the training doesn't change, and the Marines are getting better because their equipment is good, the training is very good, and so they just get better and better as people, and and the tradition of some of the uniforms and things, I think, are great.
As you look at modern college football, you went to the College of the Pacific, which I think was a fairly small school while you were there. But how does the current state of college football, with the massive recruiting and the large numbers of fans, how do you view that? Is that a big change? Is that a problem?
Well, I think that there's a terrible pressure on the kids because of agents and things of that sort that push them, and it's unfortunate that some of them get caught up in these things. But you know, usually when these people don't have any money.
Hello.
Well, I guess Sal's trying to call the other guests.
Well, and I think money is a big thing, you know, because kids go to school, they don't have any money, most of them. And you suddenly it's thrown at you, and it's very, very difficult to turn it down. And I think, I don't know what we can do to save that or change it, but we have to do something.
Well,
but I still think the spirit and all those other things are important, and I think most kids go along with that, that they still like the college spirit, the rah-rah, and the education, and so even though some don't do well with it, but I think most do.
Well, we've seen the trend of kind of overzealous recruiting. It looks like it may have even hit the Naval Academy. I know that the Army and the Navy had a long tradition leadership excellence that they thought was given by the football program. How do, in your mind, the football and leadership match up?
You know, I think it's a difficult thing to say on any broad scale. I think you learn a discipline, and I think there are some people who become leaders, and some people who are followers. And so I don't think it's anything different than most other things, although I think football and other sports are something where you learn a discipline, you get publicity, and you have to learn how to handle it, and you have to strive to do well, I mean, to become excellent at your sport. And so I think those are important things you learn. And leadership, there are certain people who are leaders, and I mean position, there are certain positions that are more for leaders. I mean, they have to become leaders if they're to be good.
And on that note, Mr. LeBaron, thank you very much. And thank you very much. I know you've got a busy day coming up with the football schedule, for taking 30 minutes to come on the show so everybody can hear what you have to say. And I wanted to remind everybody who is in the D.C. area, Wednesday at the Navy Memorial will be the Lone Sailor awardees. And I wish you the best of luck this evening. And thanks again, Mr. LeBaron.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Enjoyed talking to you.
And just as a reminder to everybody, you are listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio Midrats. If you're joining us live, make sure and come up in the chat room with the usual suspects. And both Eagle One and I will do our best to ride her and hold it and fold on any questions that you have. Now, our second guest today, we've got the Korean War covered. We're going to back up a bit and go to World War II. Our second guest is Lanier Phillips. And this gentleman, I think, is a great honor to come on, because he really is a trailblazer, but the attitude he's had and the steps he's taken in his life truly makes him a role model for all sailors. In October of 1941, at the age of 18, he joined the Navy. He's a survivor of the February 1942 sinking of the USX Truxtun DD-229, but he's not just any sailor, though. He had a habit, and we're going to talk about it, not only at his shipwreck, but also later on, of taking steps with confidence on his own to do things that other people wouldn't do. And he has a distinct honor as a trailblazer, as he was the first African-American Navy sailor to become a sonar tech, and that's no small deal for a man from his generation. Mr. Phyllis, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you.
Yes, sir, and I know you've had a little bit of a cold here, so if you need to take a break at any time, that's okay. My co-host Eagle One and I, we can build up white space pretty well. It'd be no problem at all. But all right. I wanted to back up here. It's the World War II generation everybody likes to talk about in theory, and it's always an honor to have somebody from that generation to come in and talk about their experiences. But you joined the Navy before the World War started, and so you saw it from the very beginning. And we've had some guests on here that were in the Pacific, but a lot of your experience was in the convoy escorts in the North Atlantic. And the class of destroyer that you were on, the USS Truxtun, by today's standard, is a very, very small ship, because the destroyers we produce now are the size of World War II cruisers. As a snapshot, as a young sailor coming on board a destroyer in 1941, what were some of your first impressions?
Well, first of all, it was a living quarters. I was surprised with the living quarters. And the rushing of the water, I was surprised with that. And that's about it. I knew that I was going to be a mess attendant, a steward's mate, and I would be different from the rest of the crew, and I wouldn't eat with the crew. I'd eat, you know, in the pantry with the wardroom. So it was really no surprises.
Eagle One.
Well, sir, when you joined the Navy, obviously the entire society was pretty well segregated. You ended up as you said in the mess man rate or the steward's rate. What were your living accommodations on the ship? Did they have segregated quarters for you?
Oh yes. Now, like the Truxtun, we had a compartment forward. In the mess hall, they would put the mess tables up, fasten them up on the overhead. But the mess attendants, it was five of us, four American, African American, and one Filipino. They had us back in a corner and put a big canvas sheet, you know, across the corner where you couldn't see us back there. We couldn't, you know, see out. That was a routine throughout the Navy.
What was the relationship amongst the stewards between the African-Americans and the Filipinos?
Well, it was depends on what type ship you were on. It seemed that the officers favored the Filipinos most of the time. And the Filipinos didn't go through boot camp like we did. Well, it's a training school. Unit K West and B East and what. They took them right out of the Philippines and put them on board ship, but they only got half pay. The regular pay was $21 a month, but the Filipinos only got half of the $21. And they were in the Asiatic fleet. And the African Americans was in the Atlantic fleet and the Pacific fleet. And so when they integrated all of them together, then a lot of times it would be the Filipinos would get the best jobs, say, like for the admiral's mess or the captain's mess, things like that. They would get the best job because most of the officers in the Navy prior to World War II, during World War II, were Southerners, and they held on to the slave master mentality. And that's the way it was.
Well, you were on the Truxtun as a mess man when it ran aground off. I've forgotten the name of the. Here we go. You ran aground off the Labrador, I guess it was. Was it Labrador?
Newfoundland?
Yes.
Newfoundland. And
NL is Newfoundland Labrador.
Okay. And that really opened your eyes to the fact that there could be a different world. Could you talk about that a little bit, about what happened as a result of that experience?
Yes, it taught me one of my greatest lessons in my life about advancing in life and the love and humanity that the people of St. Lawrence showed me. Once I got ashore, I decided to die. So I went back in the corner to lie down and die, and a Newfoundlander had come down there on ropes, the cliff, and he reached and pulled me up, said, "Don't lie there, you'll surely die." I knew it wasn't American, and I knew it was not a sailor because of the accent and the clothing he had on. I finally got my eyes open because the bunker sea oil, the ship broke in half, all the bunker sea oil went out to sea in gel, like jelly, and it just covered everybody. Everybody was black, you know, completely covered in it. And that was one of the experiences I had when I made it to Chambers Cove. From there to the mine, Flores Spa mine, and people began to massage my body and get the circulation going, and then to bathe me with warm, soapy water or what, and they were surprised, you know, to see a black man. I guess they had never seen a black man before. And St. Lawrence was just a little outport, and the only way you could get there was by boat, but now they have a road from St. Lawrence all the way into St. John's. But at that time, the only way you could get to St. Lawrence was by boat. And those people, they took a chance on losing their life. And all of the 46 that survived from the Truxton, the people of Newfoundland were the heroes or what, because all we did was try to save our own skin or what. But these people took a chance in that terrible storm and come down on ropes or what, come down those cliffs and managed to save 46 of us. Had it not been for the people of St. Lawrence, nobody would have survived, not one. So I have the greatest respect and the highest respect for the people of St. Lawrence.
When I read the reports of the shipwreck and the storm, is y'all had been in the storm for so long that you thought that you were in the vicinity of Iceland as opposed to Newfoundland Labrador when y'all came ashore. In a ship as small as yours was, how long had y'all been in the storm? And what was it like as a sailor to be in a storm that heavy for that long?
Well, we left Boston that Sunday. We was late leaving. We were supposed to join up with the Pollux and another destroyer, the Wilkes. And we met up with them that Monday, I believe, or maybe Tuesday morning, and off of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it was really storming. And that Wednesday morning is when we ran aground, and that was it. We ran aground, and the waves would just pick the ship up and slam it against the rocks, and eventually you could hear the steel cracking and breaking, and it just broke into by number two stack. And we only had two rafts. We lost the gig in the whale boat, and we usually carry eight rafts, but we had lost six of them in this storm. So a lot of the fellas was left stranded, you know, with no way, because when they got the second raft over, they're supposed to tie the two rafts together and pull them back to the ship, but they got hung up in the rocks. So the captain, I was on the last raft to go ashore and make it ashore.
I also read on one of your accounts of you were the only steward that was survived from your ship, and the other ones were very hesitant to get in the raft. What caused that hesitancy, and what was it that came to your mind that told you, it was time to get in the raft, Lanier, and not stay behind.
Well, the trip before the Newfoundland trip there where we ran aground, the trip before was to Reykjavik, Iceland. And the captain came on the PA system that afternoon to say Liberty commenced at 1600. He said they call us Negroes back then. He said, but no Negroes are allowed in Iceland. He said, it's not me, it's our government. They made a deal with Iceland to let us have a refueling base there. They'll never let a black man put foot on Icelandic soil. He said, but don't feel bad about it, he said, because at Port Lyote, Morocco, is the same thing. We can't let a Jew go ashore. He says, so that's the way it goes. Oh, what? So we thought it was Iceland, and the other mess attendants was hesitant because they thought, well, they might be lynched if you go ashore. And I told them, I said, well, you're going to die because ice was forming all over our bodies. And what, everybody was wet. And I learned a lot. If you stand, the spray would come before the big waves would get there. And if you stand perfectly still, didn't move anything, the spray would hit you and form an ice shield over your body. And that kept that pins and needles from sticking, you know, when the spray hit you or what. And it kind of helped out some.
Sort of like when they cover oranges in the winter down in Florida with a coat of ice to protect them from the ice storm or cold weather. When you after your rescue from the sea and your experiences in Canada, you came back and at some point you worked your way from being a mess man into being a sonar man. Could you tell me how you made that transmission? Transition.
Well, in 1948, President Truman issued a circular letter to end discrimination, and I put in for anything other than mess attendant, but it never got off the ship. A lot of the commanding officers were reluctant to carry out the order from the president, and you put in to change to some other rating. And they call them strikers when you train on the job. And so I saw that it wasn't going to get off the ship, so I wrote a letter and mailed it off the ship and to the Bureau of Naval Personnel, and they had elected a black congressman from Detroit. His name was Charles Digg. Well, Charles Digg, he was the first black U.S. Representative. And my mother had moved to Detroit, and so I went to Detroit and registered to vote to establish legal domicile. And I don't know if he ever answered my letter. I never got an answer from him. But I did get orders from the Bureau of Naval Personnel saying report to Fleet Sonar School, Key West, Florida.
Well done. You got to work the system like you have to. How when you got in, sonar tech is not. How can I use this without upsetting my friends, the bosun's mates? But being a sonar tech requires a lot of academic ability and a lot of brain work. And so it wasn't like they were trying to lowball you. They put you in a challenging rate. And when you walk through the door. How did the sonar tech community welcome you on board, and did you detect any difference there than you thought you would have?
Well, I went aboard the Bailey. My first assignment after school, DD-713, a destroyer, and they had a second class on board, so I was first class. So that made me the senior sonar tech. So Des Land Inspection Team came aboard. Well, I reported that afternoon. I was supposed to report the next morning by 0800, but I reported that night, and they woke me up before Reveille said they want you down there, sonar shack, and Des Land Inspection Team is on board. I went down, and boy, they went up behind one side and down the other. It was a lot of equipment wasn't doing what it should have done, being able to do. So I worked on it for about 7 to 2 hours there, and what, and then we did finally get orders to go to Gitmo. That's why we practiced war, you know, down at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Exactly.
Get on. We went down and made one of the highest marks, you know, it was submarine warfare.
Well, it's good to hear that inspection teams have not changed at all over the years. They still have a way of welcoming you aboard. Eagle One.
Well, after, yeah. even when you were down in at sonar school in Key West, I guess it was in those days, and as you were Navy, the society itself, despite President Truman's order to the military, society itself hadn't integrated. Tell me about your experiences as a sailor in those days, in the days before the great civil rights actions that began in the 60s with the Civil Rights Act and the marches and all that stuff.
Well, I have to go back to around 1919 when they passed a law to take no Negroes, they call us then, into the Navy. So they all got discharged except one man, Richard Turpin, and they let him stay until 1925 so he could retire. He was enlisted in 1896 and was on board the Maine when it blew up in Havana Harbor. And he also has been given credit for inventing welding underwater. But they called him back during World War II. But blacks weren't allowed to be in any parades, you know, or anything like that. And that once you made third class steward or mess attendant, you changed uniforms. You got a uniform like the officers and the chiefs, but you had to take all the brass buttons off and put black buttons on your coat. And you couldn't wear a string tie, you had to wear a bow tie or what. And on your sleeve, if you're third class, you have a crescent and a 1-inch horizontal mark. Second class, you had 2 of the marks, and first class was 3. At that time, you couldn't make chief anyway. And those were the things and the hardship that you had to go through with or what. And I did it, and I'm proud to say that I did 20 years in the Navy. And yes, it was some hardships, and some things were really hard, but I made it.
You know,
and thank you for your service.
Absolutely. And you hear that kind of tees up a question from me. I'm still a young pup. I haven't seen the history that you have, but you look at where you started, where you can't even eat on the ship without being blocked off by a big piece of canvas. You can't go on Liberty ports in some countries because they don't even want you to step foot on there just because of your DNA. To hear you find yourself in 2010, where our president's father was from Kenya, his mother was from Kansas, we are working more and more every year towards looking at each other as individuals. I'm a big fan of Morgan Freeman's attitude towards life, where, you know, instead of looking at Sal as white and Lanier is black, that I look at Lanier as Lanier and Sal as Sal. But I always want to ask somebody who has seen so much in one man's life, that when you take a deep breath, and though we always have a lot more work to do because we're humans and humans are never complete, but when you take a deep breath and you look at America at 2010 and where we go, how do you see us as we've developed as a society? And what feeling does that give you, having seen how far we have come as a people and as a Navy?
We have come a long ways, and I'm proud of the Navy. The Navy is a prototype for, you know, integration of what, and I'm proud of the Navy. I just wished I could be in the Navy today. But like here at Armed Forces Retirement Home, we have people here 80 and 90 years old, and those people are not going to change. They're going to hold on to the slave master mentality, and regardless, but my feeling is that it's going to change. We just have to wait until those people die, which won't be long, because they are not going to change. I experience it every day. You know, what do you expect for somebody born and in their 90s, and you expect them to change? They are not going to change, and they still feel that, but the literate white man is far superior to a PhD black man as far as education is concerned. That's the way they feel. Oh, and I hear them say things about President Obama, and I tell them, well, I tell you what, I say, I think that the educated young white people is the one that voted him into president.
It's true.
I said, because they are educated and they understand what's going on. And when your grandfathers, you know, when your granddaughter and grandson come home and you tell them about they giving them promotions and things like that, and it's holding you back of what, and your granddaughter, grandson said, Grandpa, you're wrong. Say, the valedictorian in my high school class was a black girl. Oh, what? So the young generation is changing it all, and you could see that during the campaign for President Obama. I've heard people say right here at home, I'd rather for my mule to be president than to have that black man there. And I've heard him say, I'm going, if he's elected president, I'm going on top of the building and jump off, you know, and things like that. They make all kind. But you've got to realize that these are Southern white men in their upper 80s and 90s. And they are not going to change, but the young, educated white people are different. They're different. They understand. And they go to school with blacks, and they understand what was going on. And they're the one that voted Obama in. What I watched the campaign, strictly watched it and kept up with it, and I could see, you know, that he was going to be elected president of the United States.
Yeah, I think whatever somebody may feel about President Obama's politics, I think his election says a lot about our country and this country's people. And I'll tell you what, I'm sorry, it's almost like you live in a time warp, and you have large percentage of my family is from Mississippi and has been for a couple of hundred years. So I know exactly what you talk about, but I see it from the Southern white man point of view. And it is a huge difference in the generations. But,
oh, yes.
I think you can always just sit back if you have to and smile and nod your head and go, you may not have changed, but my country has. And I think that a lot of that came about because of the leadership and the example that you showed. And when we started the program, I mentioned an attitude that you brought with you. And I think that attitude that you took that said, I'm not sitting on this ship and freezing to death in a storm. I'm getting on the boat. And
yes,
just like you said, you know what? President Truman says we're integrated. I'm calling the bluff. Go send me someplace. And you jumped right into sonar tech school. And you excelled, and you took advantage of the Navy and the country as it progressed and provided opportunities. And that's why I think it's a great opportunity for those who are in D.C. to see you in 3D. It's great to always have you on the show and to talk to you. And I think as you get a chance to perhaps leave the time warp behind at the Armed Forces Retirement Home, and we'll meet with people and their 40s and younger, that's got to make you feel that you helped earn where we are as a country.
Absolutely.
And where we are as a Navy. And that's something I'm real proud of you as a young whippersnapper myself. It's all relative, of course. But I would hope that you take that on board for yourself, the fact that you really did set that example.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you bringing me on to tell my story. I look at Mississippi, it's the only state left that still flies the Confederate flag over the Capitol. Alabama took it down, Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana, and they say they're not going to take it down in Mississippi. And the thing about it, what does the flag represent? The man who designed the flag, James Miles, his buddy Beauregard from Georgia asked him why he didn't put the Christian cross on there. He said he didn't want to antagonize the Southern Jews, so he put the Andrew Cross of Scotland. And the only complaint he ever had was it looked like a set of suspenders. And he said, if you want to know what it means, say, I'll tell you in three words. He says, slavery, slavery, slavery. And then you go again, if you read America Interprets the Civil War, on page 34, when Alexander Stephen, the vice president of the Confederacy, spoke in Savannah, Georgia on March the 21st, and he said that the Constitution and God made a mistake when he said all men are created equal. He said no man of African heritage is equal to the white man. So, you know, those things still hang on, and those people still hang on to that. And that's why I see it. I see it on a daily basis. But like I say,
after you retired from the Navy, what did you do, and where were you doing it?
Yeah, I worked for EG&G International as a technical specialist, and I worked on some very important projects. I believe in 63, when they lost the bombs off Spain, I worked on that project. And when we lost the Thresher off the Continental Shelf, down around Nantucket, I worked on that project, you know, working with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. But my employer was EG&G International. I just moved right on up.
And Mr. Phillips, I'll tell you what, not just in your Navy life, but also in the civilian side of the house, I think you've set a real good example and a real good template for a lot of people to go forward. And if I'm half as put together as you are, and the good Lord, if he lets me live as long as you have, and I think things will have worked out real well for us. Thank you very much for taking time this Sunday to come on Mid-Rats. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
All right, and thank you for having me.
And everybody, I just wanted to remind you, if you are in the D.C. area and you get a chance, as always, go by the Neighbor Memorial. Get a schedule of the different events that they're going to have going on through the year. And this Wednesday, they will have the Lone Sailor Awardees. Go to the website, see what the itinerary is. It's well worth your show. Thank you very much for listening and joining us in the chat room, and I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
Piccadilly for your